The end of Acts chapter 5, and there's a lot of stuff that was written in your handouts about Gamaliel and some of the disputes that go on between what he says and what's recorded by Josephus, and you can read those on your own time. What I want to focus on is just briefly touching again what happened to the apostles, because on what grounds did they arrest all 12 of the apostles legally? They had no right to arrest the apostles. On what grounds did they charge the apostles legally? Yeah, but legally, under Jewish law, what did they charge them with? Well, not yet. They couldn't charge them with anything. They're going to charge Stephen with blasphemy, although it was falsely. And they charged Jesus with blasphemy, although it was false. But what charge did they have, or what authority or legality did they have to arrest and then beat the apostles? No. You know, they did it according to the law, probably 39 stripes apiece, but they didn't have any grounds to beat them. They were unlawfully arrested, unlawfully charged, and then unlawfully beaten. Now, what was the apostles' response to that at the end of Acts chapter 5? Yeah, let's look at that. Look again at verse 41. It says, "Then they left the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name." And I want you to note what it doesn't say. "And they left the presence of the council and went to the Romans to appeal in a legal civil suit against the Jewish brethren." You know, you don't read that in there. Why am I bringing this up? Okay. Martin Luther King Jr., I don't believe in a lot of things he taught. I do believe in a lot of things he taught. I want to share one thing that I think he nailed this morning. During the Civil Rights Movement, this is one of the things that he discussed, because he discussed just laws and unjust laws. And he was really quiet about it. All right. Hold on. Hewlin 1, BJ 0. All right. Oh, no, it's the... That's why. Okay. Let's try it again. Hey, look at that. And that came out in the wrong order. That's all right. But this is what he said. "An individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law." Now, what is he talking about, and what does this have to do with Acts chapter 5? What was done to the blacks was not right by justice standpoints, by legal standpoints, even though they had made laws. It just wasn't right what took place. Now, basically, his response was, "We can go down swinging, but what good would that do if they went down swinging and fighting the entire way?" Well, his point is, if you're going to oppose an unjust law, you have to be willing, in breaking that law, to accept the what? The consequence for that. Christ promised as Christians that we are going to be persecuted. Period. And so here's what Peter writes. He says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you." Now, we live in a country where we have been blessed with some 200 plus years of Christians not really having to face persecution. And now that it's starting to happen, the beginnings and the roots of it, a lot of Christians are speaking up like something strange is happening. Like, this is against my rights. This isn't supposed to happen. And so you see a lot of people who profess to be Christians, when their rights are violated, what are they doing in return? You see them going down swinging. You see lawsuits. You see people, you know, trying to sue this person because of what was done to their business or their bakery or whatever is done. And here's the bottom line. If I'm going to stand up for godly principles, be they legal or illegal, pop quiz, the sweet cakes business. In Oregon law, Marv and I got to sit in on a talk by a young attorney this last week. By Oregon law, a company, small business, whatever it might be, cannot refuse any services they offer, regardless of sexual orientation. That's Oregon law. In other words, if someone comes in and asks you to participate in endorsing an immoral lifestyle and you tell them, I will not, you are breaking the law by Oregon law. Now, when you do that, there is going to be what? Consequences. What is the right and proper Christian response is the question. But it's against my rights. It's unjust.
Yes, it is.
Okay. This is the voice we hear from the American culture impressed on Christians. We are to stand up for our rights. We're to stand up for, you know, our what's just. Let me give you just I know that this is going to shock you, but our justice system is not exactly the perfect standard of justice. Okay. But here's the point. This does not mean to not speak out. This does not mean to not say this thing is wrong. But what it is to say is that we need to stop going down swinging and fighting for our rights. And if we're going to be persecuted, we need to be willing to accept that. And here's what Peter says about it at the end of Peter. Let me get close enough. He says, therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing what? Good. Christ said, you have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, what? Love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, the Christian's response is to do what? Sue him because he had no right to slap you on the cheek? No, he says you do what? Here's the whole point, and there's a lot of debate about this, especially in the Christian community today, because we haven't had to deal with this in America for a long time. But the Bible is very clear. We need to start preparing our hearts and our minds and our attitudes because persecution is coming. And it's going to be unjust, and it's going to be wrong, and it's going to mean that some of us lose our jobs. It's going to mean that some of us maybe go to prison. You know, it is very likely that within the next 15, 20 years, I might wind up in prison because I'm preaching the truth and against certain things. That might become very, very possibly in the next few years, unlawful to preach against. You know what? I'm going to preach it, and if they take me to jail, that's okay. That's what we have to start preparing ourselves for. Now, that does not mean we beg for persecution. In Acts 8, when persecution started, what did the church do? They dispersed. There's nothing wrong with trying to seek an area where you can help to raise your family in a better place and teach the truth where you're not going to be persecuted. But when you are, there's a way that we are to respond, and we need to start thinking about that. Because it's the way the apostles responded, it's the way that Christ responded, it's the way that Stephen responded, it's going to be the way that we see everything unfail with the church in the book of Acts. And I just want us to start thinking about those things. Rebuttals are perfectly fine and we can talk about them. So we want to move on to Acts 6, but any thoughts about that or any questions about that? Yeah. That's right. We need to be wise as serpents, as John reminded me last week. So, good. Yeah.
I'd also like to read, if you go back to 1 Peter 3, especially starting in verse
Mm-hmm. And so he says, now who is there, this is 1 Peter 2, 12, 13, now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ, the Lord is holy. Always be prepared. Always, this is a verse that we always use a lot. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Absolutely. I can't put that any better. Thank you so much for sharing that. That's right. Anything else on this subject? Am I missing hands? All right. Let's go into Acts chapter 6. All right. Now, the apostles had just been released from custody, and immediately, this is amazing, they're beaten for preaching the gospel. What do they immediately go back to doing? They're preaching the gospel daily, they're in temples, they're in the temple, they're in synagogues, they're in houses day to day. The church is continuing to grow. But here's the sad part. Up to this point, the church had been completely unified. They were of the same mind, of the same spirit. They were sharing what they had so that those in need could have. But we're going to come across our first... maybe you can call it an instance of disunity, and whether it was incidental or by accident, it was. The language seems to appear as though a group believed that it was not by accident but intentional. So let's find out what's going on. Verse 1, now in these days when the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews, because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. Okay, now remember, in Acts 4, people were selling their property and they were laying the funds at the feet of the apostles. Now what's being done with that money at this point? What are they doing with all these funds? Yeah. Those who had need were being taken care of, and God has always set aside for His people to take care of two groups specifically. What two groups are those? Orphans and widows. And here, there is a group of Christians that were Hellenists, we're going to separate those in just a second, that were saying, our widows are being neglected. Now that word seems to imply that it was intentional, and let's look at why they might have believed so. Whether it was or not, it seems that they believed it was. There were two groups of Jews. We're not talking political, like Pharisees and Sadducees or Zealots or anything like that. But you were either a Jew born in Palestine, and your native language would have been Hebrew, and you would have been a Hebrew Jew, okay? But if you were born outside of Palestine by Jewish parents and your language was Greek by native tongue, then if you were Greek by native tongue, what version of the Old Testament would you study and use in your synagogues? The Septuagint. Kevin, Blue Star. You remember last class. That's awesome. The LXX. And so that would have been their text. It's the Greek version of the Old Testament. Now, how do you think a lot of the Hebrew Jews viewed the Hellenistic Jews? Okay. They're like, we're the real Jews, but you're like the semi-Jews. You're not as holy, because if you lived in a Greek culture, what likely would you also be more likely to practice and become a part of? All the things that go on with those types of cultures, right? And so there's two groups, and here, the Hellenist widows are being neglected in the distribution of food. Now, we don't know what the organization system was at this point for taking care of the needy. We only know that the money was laid at the apostles' feet, and that at that point it was distributed in some form or fashion to take care of the needy. So, there was a group of widows that weren't getting anything. And here we have a motive. Why would the Hellenistic women be ignored by the Hebrews, perhaps?
Language barrier.
okay, maybe it's a language barrier. Well, I think Rochelle might be onto something more, because it might have been a prejudice taking place. That, well, we're going to take care of our own the first, because remember, these are new Christians. Were they still very involved in their Judaistic traditions and culture? I mean, prejudices don't go away in a year or, you know, it takes a period of time for people to overcome those things. That likely could have been what's taking place here. Whether or not it was on purpose or not, we don't know, but at least the language seems to believe that the Hellenists thought it was. So, yeah.
You know, the text doesn't say here, BJ, but along with Rochelle's thoughts too, I wonder how the Jews that were proselytes, you know, converted to Jews, I wonder if they were treated kind of as second-class citizens mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Peter was guilty of this himself after years of the church growing.
Mm-hmm. And it was with the Gentiles and the Jews. So good point. Yeah. So here's the response from the apostles, which I think is genius. Because they come to the apostles with a problem, and basically they're asking them to do what? Fix it. Here's our problem, you fix it. Okay? How often do kids do that to parents, by the way? I remember doing that all the time. I have a problem, you fix it, right? And so here's going to be their response. They're going to say, you know, one, they're going to establish a priority list of what needs to be done and by whom. And then instead of just saying, we're going to fix your problem, don't worry, they're going to turn it around and ask them to be a part of the solution to this problem, okay? So here's how they respond. Verse 2, and the 12 summoned the full number of disciples. Now that's what the ESV reads. Does anyone else read something different than the full number of disciples?
Multitude.
The multitude of disciples? The congregation?
All
the disciples? Okay. The Greek simply means a large number or multitude. It's generally interpreted to mean all the Christians. And at this point, how many would there be? I mean, at the minimum, 20,000? So that's a lot of Christians. That's not beyond the realm of possibility. The language seems to imply within the context, though, and this is just a thought, that it might have been the apostles summoning the entire group of the Hellenists together. Now, why would I say that? Well, we're going to see. One, all of the men that are picked have Greek names. All seven men. What does that mean all of them were? All of them were Hellenistic Jews. All of the men that were picked. And so, if you were only speaking to a group of Hellenistic Jews, a large multitude, no matter what seven you pick, they're all going to be what? Hellenists. They're going to have Greek names. So, that's just one thing that tends towards it. And it also, it would make sense for the apostles to say, if you feel like you've been neglected, personally see to it that what? That it's taken care of, that you're a part of the solution, that that's not what takes place. It doesn't really matter either way, just a small thing in the text for us to kind of see and look at. But here's their response to them. They summoned the whole multitude, be it the entire church or be it just the Hellenistic disciples. And it says, it is not right that we should give up preaching of the word of God to serve tables. Now, wait a second. I thought taking care of widows and orphans in need was pure and undefiled religion by James chapter 1. Isn't that a good and right thing to do? Amen? Why would the apostles say we're not going to do that? How could they take something that is good and right and say it's not our job to do it? What do we think about it? Okay, they can't do everything.
Well, the greater need at this time is the preaching of the gospel.
Okay.
Because the apostles were appointed, commissioned that by Jesus.
That's the key here. Yeah, Kevin.
The people that are going to be with that congregation or that group of people all the time, too, they're going to be moving around. They need somebody permanent to put in place to do that.
Okay, perfect. We need to establish some structure here, is basically what the apostle said. And there's a principle that we need to understand here. When you say yes to something, you say no to what?
Something else.
That's just a principle with everything in life. So if they were going to say yes to the serving of tables, inevitably, what were they saying no to? the time adequately devoted to the preaching of the word and to prayer, as we're going to see. Because when Jesus sent them out, this was their mission they were commissioned to do. He said, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all I had commanded you. Their job was to teach and to confirm the word. That was their job as apostles. And so it's not that they did not think this was a need that needed to be done or accomplished or seen to. They simply recognized their priorities and they said, this is not something that I can do. Something that we wind up in trouble with sometimes is not being able to say no as Christians. And sometimes we can say yes so much that we spread ourselves too thin and we actually don't do much good with whatever we're involved with. As Christians, it's okay and appropriate sometimes to say no because we are devoted to something different that God has asked for us to do in our life. Yeah, Marv.
My understanding on this chapter, maybe it's wrong, we clarified that they didn't actually were appointing deacons there. They were actually appointing seven men to do a specific duty and only that duty. It didn't ask them to do anything else. And whereas a deacon is carrying out all types of duties.
We're going to look at that because that's a question that a lot of people have. Are these deacons or are they not deacons? So we're going to address that in just a second. So we'll just hold on to that thought for just a second. That being said, man, I wish I could see. they are given qualifications for these men, though. And they say, this is what we're going to do. I want you to pick out seven men, and here's going to be their qualifications. First off, they're to be of what? Good repute. Now, what does that mean?
Good reputation amongst the people.
Okay. They're men of integrity. They're men of honor. They're held in honor, not just amongst the church, but amongst those that are outside. That's really important, especially with a job like this. People that are of good integrity, right? Because if you have people of bad integrity, to see to it that certain people are not neglected or prejudiced against, you know, that's setting yourself up to fail, you know. So you want to put people that are going to be honest and are going to evaluate the situation and take care of it the way it ought to be done in the right way. And so he says they have to be of good reputation. Yeah, Matt.
Well, the Holy Spirit's got two things he's going to complete here. One is showing that they can take care of themselves. And by appointing these men, and we know because we've all read ahead, and we know a couple of these guys become more than just food servers.
That's right. Good.
So there's good in these people, and they need to quit being so prejudiced in there.
Yeah, and if that's what was going on, that's exactly correct, and that's a huge possibility. So second thing, they're supposed to be not just of good repute, but they're to be full of the Spirit. Now, some people want to say this means that they were able to do what?
But
miraculous things. Now, up to this point, the context is going to demand that that's not what this means. Because up to this point, who have been the only ones that have been recorded as performing great signs and wonders in front of the people? The apostles. And what was the only way that we're going to know, jumping ahead a little bit, from Acts chapter 8, that the Spirit was given to other people? The spiritual gifts were given by the laying on of the hands of the apostles. And we read that in Acts chapter 8, I believe in verse 18. And so when we understand that, what could this be talking about then? Men that are full of the Spirit.
They're spirit-driven. They are totally focused upon God and His will. And that was paramount. And so it's obvious. You can see a person who's driven by the Spirit. That's what they do. Their mind is focused solely upon God and His will, and they would know who those people are. Just as you see in a congregation of God's people, there are those who are very, their works are seen because of their actions and what they do. They're spirit-driven, and they're those that just, they're there.
Okay, good. Galatians chapter 5, the works of the works of the flesh are evident, right? And then he goes on to say, but the fruits of the Spirit are what? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control. What's that? Brotherly kindness, there you go, gentleness. And so, if you're going to select men to be a part of a compassionate role and a compassionate position, then these ought to be men that are going to be full of the works of the Spirit. That the Spirit was within them as they had received it upon their baptism, and that they were Spirit-led, they considered others as more important than themselves. Barnabas-like people is what we're talking about. And so not just full of the Spirit, but also full of wisdom. Again, some people want to say this is a supernatural wisdom. I would argue this is simply one that was in tune and understood the will of the Lord and understood the will of God. And wisdom is essential, especially with things like this. You know, if you were just to talk to the elders, there's a lot of wisdom that is needed in addressing people's needs. Because first off, you have to assess, is this person really in need or are they not in need? And then secondly, you have to address, if they're in need, how much need are they in? You know, there's a lot of questions and discernment that goes on behind a position like this. And so you don't want to elect some, you know, teenage kids that are just going to, hey, bread for everybody, you know, and throw it all away. These are men that were supposed to be discerning and wise and understood. And so you bring all these things together, and here is what the apostles end up saying is, this is the qualifications, but we will devote ourselves to prayer and to ministry. Those are always going to go together. And the good question for us is, do we talk to God as much as we talk to other people about God? And if there's not an equivalence there, then I need to assess my own prayer life, or I need to assess my own life as a minister. Because both those things go hand in hand. And so, they picked seven men. And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they chose Stephen. Now, he's going to be our main focus for the rest of this chapter and the rest of chapter 7. And then they pick Philip. Now, Philip is going to be our focus in chapter 8. And then they pick five other men that we really don't know much of anything about. There is, oh my goodness, I can't do that because I'm just going to have to go here. I got to get new glasses. You have Prochorus and Nicanor and Timon and Parmenas and Nicholas. Now, some people have disputed, there was a tradition started by the Catholic Church in a commentary around 300 AD that this Nicholas is the one whom we read about in Revelation, the works of the Nicolaitans. That's just a tradition. There's not a lot of support for that. So if you hear that this is the guy, he's the apostate that went off, maybe, but we really don't know. We don't know much about these other five men. We just know what Luke has recorded for us about Stephen and about Philip. So they put these men forward, and here's what's interesting. They set before the apostles, and the apostles prayed and did what? Laid hands on them. Now, what's that about? Well, in Acts 8, we know that the giving of spiritual gifts was given through the laying on of hands. And very next verse, within the context, we're going to see, I just got to do it here, that the word of God continued to increase and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great number of priests became obedient to the faith. And then you read verse 8, and Stephen, full of grace and power, was doing great wonders and signs among the people. As the first time we have a recording of anyone except the apostles being able to do supernatural things, to do miracles and perform signs and wonders. Where did Stephen get that? It appears that the apostles laid their hands on these men and were able to give them gifts that they needed to not only accomplish this task, but other tasks. So the question Marv brought up, are these deacons? No, it's interesting, we don't even read the word elders until Acts chapter 11. And so the church has been established for a while. Why aren't there deacons and elders? I'll just throw that out there. Why don't we read about them yet? Okay, the apostles at this point, they're serving kind of as the shepherds and the elders over the church, aren't they? Now, immediately after the church is dispersed, you're going to see, once he's converted, after a period of time, Paul is going to start going around with different people, and what are they doing in each church? Now they start establishing elderships and deacons. So there is a possibility that there had been elders and deacons that had been established at this point, but we just don't know. It was as there was need within the church that that began to become what was revealed to the apostles and was the plan for the church and the organization of the church. So are these deacons? Well, they're doing the work of deacons, but the text doesn't call them that, so we don't know. That's a lot of scholars think, yes, these are deacons, but there's some dispute about that. It doesn't really matter for our case. These are men that were full of the Spirit, that were sent to do a mission for the apostles, and then, as I think Matt brought out, these were not just men that were going to serve tables. They were going to do much more. And that's what we read Stephen. Stephen's not just serving tables, but we read Stephen now doing what? He's now preaching, and he's doing signs and wonders like the apostles. And here we have our transition verse, by the way. We talked about those. This is Luke's key to us that we're about to have a transition into the next part of Acts, because Acts chapters 1 through 7 are about what? Jerusalem. Acts chapters 8 through 12 are about what region? This is our key, that we're about to go into Judea and Samaria from Luke. And so Stephen is preaching. And then it says, verse 9, that some of those who belonged to the synagogue of the freedmen, as it was called, and of the Cyrenians and the Alexandrians and those of Cilicia and Asia rose up and disputed with Stephen, but they could not withstand the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. Well, if Stephen was inspired by the Holy Spirit, who can withstand that reasoning from the Old Testament scriptures? Now, this synagogue is debated. What is the synagogue of the freedmen? Really, the only thing we can say for sure is it would have been a Hellenistic synagogue, because the Hebrews wouldn't have allowed a lot of times Hellenistic Jews to become a part of them, and so there was just synagogues that were devoted to Hellenistic Jews, where the Septuagint was read. And this is what's really interesting. Those who gather that had been a part of this synagogue and worshiped there are from these locations, and one of them is Cilicia. Now, that's really important because the capital of Cilicia is Tarsus. Who do we know is from Tarsus?
Saul.
Who's going to be present at Stephen's stoning? Who was likely a worshiper at the synagogue of the freedmen?
Saul.
It just fits the context here. And so Saul likely had been disputing Stephen before he was ever converted to the gospel. Isn't that amazing to think about? It's a very big possibility. At least he knew who Stephen was. We know that, and he approved of his persecution and his death. And so here these men are trying to dispute Stephen. They cannot, and so they're going to take it the Sanhedrin style. If you can't shut him up, then what are you going to do? You're going to try to kill him. And so, here's what we read in the rest of the text. Verse 11. Then they secretly instigated men and said, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God." And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council. Now that's the what council? What are they called?
Sanhedrin.
And they set up false witnesses who said, "This man never ceases to speak words against this holy place," that would be the temple, "and the law, for we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses delivered to us." All right, let's just stop there for a moment. Does this sound really similar to the arrest and trial of anyone else that we read about in the New Testament? Who does this look strikingly similar to? Jesus. They are. They brought Jesus, seized him, brought him before the council in the temple, and had false witnesses stand before him and convict him of blasphemy. It's the same thing they do with Stephen. You know what's really interesting, though, is a couple things here. The Sadducees, they had political power and they had influence with Rome, but they didn't have that much influence among the people. What sect of Jews had the influence among the people? The Pharisees. That's who we see involved here. What the Sadducees couldn't do, the Pharisees now do. They have influence among the people. They stir up the people. They're the teachers of the synagogues who were formerly for the apostles and held them in great honor and fear in the church, and now they're turned against. And they stir up the people and they bring false accusations against Stephen. And this is just going to be the way that everything plays out here. They had great fear of the apostles, but now they see an opportunity. Here's someone else rising up in the spectacle and in the honor of the Christians, and now he's doing signs and wonders, but he's not one of the 12, so they jump on an opportunity and they seize him. Okay, yeah, Matt. Priests.
Became obedient to the faith. Mm-hmm. So these people were turning their own against them.
Yeah.
And so they had to
do something about it.
Do something drastic to try to put a stop to it.
Good point.
Stephen just happens to be one.
Mm-hmm. And I overlooked that. I'm glad that you brought that back up. I had a note about that because the Sanhedrin, remember, is made up of the elders and the scribes and then the what? The priests. And so if a great number of the priests were turning over, we've got a serious problem on their hands, don't we? The Pharisees were forced, so to speak, to act here. But it's not the apostles, they're going to grab Stephen. Now this is really interesting. Stephen is set before them, and some of the things that they bring up, the blasphemies that they bring up or claim he's speaking, it could be really simple to turn a slight twist on the things that Jesus had preached to make it sound like something blasphemous. And it very well could have been the things that Stephen was preaching that they heard as blasphemy. If he was talking about anything that we read about in the book of Hebrews, they would have said what? Blasphemy. You say that Christ is a fulfillment of the law, that Christ is better than the angels, they would call it blasphemy. And they because they rejected that Jesus was the Christ. And all these different things, if he was preaching that Christ said about his resurrection that he would tear this place down and build it up again, you see how they could use that to say he's saying he's going to destroy the temple? And so they present all these false witnesses, and he's standing before them. And here's what's really interesting is look at verse 15. And gazing at him, all who sat in the council saw his face was like an angel, like the face of an angel. Now, what's the face of an angel look like? Who's seen an angel recently? I wake up to one every morning, but... All right, good. No, I'm just kidding. So, what does the face of an angel look like? Innocent, radiant. How many guesses could we have? You know, the likelihood that they had seen angels, though, is very possible. Remember, when Christ rose, what was at his tomb? There were two angels. Angel visitations that were visible to men were kind of frequent during that time period. Yeah, Dave.
Christ's resurrection, when he went back to the Father, there were two angels that said that very thing. Why mm-hmm. do you stand staring? He's going to come back. So they would know what that looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And so, with that being said, that's probably what the council is making reference. What he looked like was something different. His face had a sense of peace and maybe innocence and truthfulness about him. And that's what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. Here's John.
These people may have never seen it. saw was the face of an angel. Mm. That may be a correct interpretation.
That's a big possibility.
They actually did see it, and Luke is telling us that that's what they were looking at. Maybe they didn't acknowledge it, but that's what they were saying.
Mm-hmm. And so here's maybe an example. You look at Moses when he came down from Mount Sinai. What did he have to have over his face?
A veil.
A veil, because what was he doing? He was just glowing and radiant, as Donna put it. Maybe that's what's being described here. Maybe it's like that of when Christ was transfigured. He was different. That's all. He was transformed. His clothes were different. He was pure white. He was glowing. And so we don't really know for sure what that means, but we do know, I appreciate what John said, Luke would have known what an angel looked like. And he says that's what they were looking at. That's what his face shone like. And if nothing else, that demonstrates in a physical manifestation that Stephen had the what?
The Spirit.
The Spirit of God within him. Yeah, Matt.
Well, I think it goes back to what they thought too, what they said, that he spoke as a man or someone with authority.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah, Dave,
yeah,
then we're done.
This goes back a little bit, but you look back even during the times of Moses and when all these problems arose, men were selected to deal with the judging of the people and their situations because Moses couldn't handle it all. And there's a precedence that happened even back then. And then you come into this situation where the apostles and preaching the word was more important because it's by the foolishness of the message preached to say God chose to save man, and so then they appoint these seven. And then you can even take that further into today, into our time, we have elders and deacons that serve, and so this is not anything new. This is God's design, and it was made this way, and we're following the same thing, and we're doing the same thing today.
Good.
Just a point.
Good. I'm getting the cut sign. So that's chapter 6, and it bleeds right into chapter 7 that we'll cover next time. So.